Good evening. This is an interview for the Michigan Writer Series, Friday, October 5th, 2007. Tonight, I'm talking with Keith Taylor, poet, writer, and coordinator of the undergraduate program in creative writing at the University of Michigan. Welcome, Keith.
Hi.
How did you first get started writing?
My family moved to the States from Western Canada when I was 12, which is a difficult age anyway. And it was a difficult time in history. And we moved from, that was in the 60s, early 60s, I guess. And we moved from a rural environment to South Bend, Indiana, which even then was kind of a beat-up post-industrial city.
Right.
And was having, Studebaker had closed, and it was having a terrible time. So it was a terrible place to live. I was completely, people made fun of me. I was kicked out of school for not saying the Pledge of Allegiance. And, of course, I was too proud to tell them I didn't know the Pledge of Allegiance. So I was, you know, barely here. They kicked me out of school. And some point in there, I mean, I'd always been kind of a reader. And I came from a very religious family, so words were always important, and we were always memorizing the Bible and things. But at some point in there, I was bitten deeply by the reading bug. Stopped sleeping so I could stay under my covers and read books, and read absolutely everything, not just what 12-year-olds read.
Right.
And after that, it wasn't long into that before I decided, oh, I want to do this too. And I wrote something, and I'm not even quite sure why I wrote it. I remember it distinctly. Somewhere in my files I have a copy of it. It was looking out my window on snow and at you know, the backyard in a blue-collar neighborhood in South Bend, Indiana. And I took it into my school the next day, and then somebody said, oh, that's a poem. And I said, oh, is it? And he said, yeah, you just got to do something with it. And I said, what? He said, oh, you know, break up the lines, make it look funny. So I did, and gave it to my English teacher, and my English teacher loved it. And at some point there, that became my self-definition.
Right.
And once you create those self-definitions for yourself, it's, you know, the doors are either open or other doors are closed, and we just kept going. So it really became the reading, and then the writing became obsessive and continues to be obsessive. Low these many years later.
Did you find it difficult to get published in the first time? Or?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the publishing is always a problem. And I mean, again, because I was bitten so early,
right.
I started trying to do it, trying to get published early. So I was getting rejected by everybody. I'd already expected that I'd be rejected by everybody. So it was kind of fun. When I was 19, I sort of dropped out of college and went to Europe and sort of bummed around Europe and did all kinds of things. On very little money. I had the year I was, what was I, 20 to 21, so 1972 to 1973, I was living in a tiny little unheated room in not a very nice section of Paris, and I decided I was going to send everything to magazines constantly. To English-speaking magazines, and I was living in France. So most of the money I had, I spent more money on postage than I spent on food. I was thinner then, significantly thinner. And I would get these rejection letters back, and I did the sort of classic young bohemian thing. I pasted them up on my wall, and I did so much I almost filled one whole wall with rejection letters. And when I left that room, I remember I sort of packed up my backpack, and I looked back at that room, and I said, you know, who's going to be the next person here, and what are they going to do with all these rejection letters in English? But, you know, you keep at it, and then you get a couple poems here, you get an essay there, you can get a story there, and sort of slowly it builds up, and the first time somebody ever asks you for something, it's like, oh, wow, because the editor asked me for something. But that's after 10 or 15 years of being rejected.
Right.
And you know, you publish in very obscure places, and it doesn't seem as if anybody ever reads it. But yet, slowly, it seems to build up, and then the little books come, and then the bigger books come, and then you find yourself, you know, reviewed in places you've never been by people you've never met. And, you know, you find yourself on Michigan State Library's website, and you know, it's sort of all sort of accretes and builds up. It's a very odd process. I think it's a different process for some people. There are people who go out there and publish big things right away, and the whole world pays attention. But for most of us, it's pretty slow. For some people, it's dispiriting. It wasn't dispiriting for me. It just seemed that that's the way it had to be.
Well, that's good. Was there, what drew you to writing poetry versus, say, novels or more short stories?
Yeah, I wish I had a better answer for that. I really do think it's probably a reflection of temperament, probably my experience of the world, probably an attraction to certain kinds of language that may indeed have been formed by being surrounded constantly as a very young person with King James English.
Right, definitely.
So some of that did not, you know, as I told an interviewer a while back who'd asked a similar question, it's not that I don't do the same amount. I work as hard as a novelist works.
Right.
But I just can't seem to carry it. I've tried four or five of them. I've never got past page 60. So, you know, my imagination, my abilities tend to go into other directions. I have not done one. I mean, I've edited or co-translated books that have gotten to be substantially sized books, but I've never done a single effort that has gotten over 200 pages. And I'd like to, you know. Yeah, it'd be fun. But we'll see if it happens.
We'll look forward to that if it does.
Good, good. That's why let's both live so long.
What do you find most challenging about writing poetry?
Poetry is a small world, but it's a very intense world. And there are certain kinds of fashions that bloom and blossom and dominate and then die very quickly. And it's very hard, even for somebody my age, which is now 55, to read this poetry by often younger contemporaries or by our contemporaries, understand its passion and excitement, but then not be sort of bowled over by this particular wagon, a particular kind of literary fashion. And then, you know, and you can go for periods when you feel very, very out of fashion, and people treat you as if you're very out of fashion. And then suddenly, boom, that changes and everybody's interested in what you do. So it's very hard to sort of resist that kind of those kinds of pressures and keep on your own track. There's lots of writers who are much more absolutely convinced of their own genius, and they just keep going straight ahead and just ignore everybody else. For me, and I think for most poets, it's a harder process than that. Because you do want to learn from these things, you don't want to reject these things, but yet you don't want to. There's no point in writing to the fashion. You still have to try to find whatever is your experience of the words and your experience of reality. So, you know, finding that that's the hardest thing. Keep going, and to keep. But on the other hand, you still kind of have to try to stay fresh, and it gets harder and harder to stay fresh. You know, somebody once said that about poetry, the young are never wrong. That may be indeed the case. So, you know, you still try to act young even though you're bald and gray. And right. Me, not you.
How has living and working in Michigan influenced your writing?
I came to Michigan just almost a fluke, but that was 32 years ago, so I've stayed. You know, I married a woman from Detroit, and I have a Michigander daughter. So, you know, this is I almost belong. I think, you know, and some of this just happens just by because you live here. I mean, I've gotten to be very committed to and attracted to and often in awe of the Great Lakes Basin. So I certainly feel as if I'm a Great Lakes writer now. I've gotten to know a fair amount about Great Lakes literature, and that's become part of my life, teaching and talking about that. The fluctuations of you know, this particular state, and you know, right now we're not in the best of shape financially, and right. So it's interesting to follow all of those things. This is where I came of age, you know. This is where, I mean, yeah, I was not that young when I came here, but nonetheless, this is where my imagination matured. This is where I certainly, you know, matured as a human being, not even as a writer. So I have certain commitments here. So it's, in many ways, I think it's shaped what I do a lot. I have adopted certain sort of Midwestern attitudes about the art, which are tend to be a lot more sort of, ah, shucks, I'm not good enough for that. We tend to be a lot sort of more try to hide ourselves under everybody's radar, which is generally a problem, I think, with many of our writers. But I totally understand that. It's like, yeah, that's me too. The part of me that's involved in environmental issues and it's involved in environmental writing, nature writing is very much about this place. And this is the stuff I know. So, I mean, basically, I think, other than those vestiges of childhood, which of course are always going to creep in, Michigan has informs everything I write.
Yeah. We're certainly glad to have you here.
Thanks.
Tell us more about one of your latest works, Battered Guitars, with which you translated with William Reeder. Inspired you to work on this project and take on such a project?
Well, I'm going to actually read a couple of those poems today and read a couple of mine that are sort of about it. When I was bitten by that reading thing, and I think this is very true of most readers, that most real, you know, passionate readers, that they have something that they latch onto, and that's often they have no explanation for. I know a poet of international reputation, and her real reading passion is murder mysteries. She's just obsessed with murder mysteries, and she'll read a murder mystery. But she never doesn't tell everybody that that's what she really
is.
For some reason, when I was bitten by that writing in a fairly poor family in South Bend, Indiana, from a very religious background, for some reason there in the mid-60s, I began reading modern Greek literature in translation. Now, why? Who knows? Somebody probably told me about Zorba the Greek, and there was that great Anthony Quinn movie, of course, with Zorba the Greek, although I don't think I saw that movie till much later. And the author of that novel, Nikos Kazantzakis, had a lot of other things in print at that time that are no longer in print. Then I started finding other things a few years later when I was living in France. I got very obsessed with the poems of Constantine Cavafy, the main poet of modern Greek language, through his French translations, not through English at that point. So once I came to Michigan, and I was up at Central, and a guy met Bill Reeder, who was originally from Detroit, but had just moved there, and he'd been living for years in Germany. And his professional life was as a New Testament scholar. He does ancient Greek, does Hebrew, and does all those. But he's loved modern Greek. Continues to structure his life around getting to Greece as often as possible. So his Greek was pretty good. So he came back one time, and this would be the mid-90s, and he said, I ran across this guy, Kostas Kyriotakis, and there doesn't seem to be any translations of him in English. We discovered that's because he's so difficult to translate. His poems are very metrical, very, very. They rhyme and they have strict meters. They're also very bleak, and I'm not a very bleak person. So he'd never come into English, although he was fairly important in Greece. So Bill said, "Well, let's try to do this." Now Bill will readily admit that he's much more of a scholar. We use the less nice word pedant about things, and so he would do. We started doing this when he would do sort of real literal cribs, and then we would start arguing about it. The first day we sat down to work, we spent 4 hours on 8 lines of poetry, and that was on a Saturday. And the next day, on Sunday, we spent 6 hours on 4 more lines. So we spent 14 hours. On 14 lines. So it was like an hour line, and then we're going, well, this is going to take several lifetimes. Good thing our man died young. Our man was a suicide at the age of 32. Then, right at that point, U of M, University of Michigan, began a modern Greek studies program. And I just sort of casually ran this by the woman who was the language teacher. And she said, well, you should learn the language. And I said, so I went and I took modern Greek at U of M for four years. And it was fun. I mean, I went modern Greek 101. It's just a fairly large program now, but almost the beginning of the program. Went to the first class, and there were six beautiful 18-year-old Greek American girls in the front row, and there was me in the second row. They sort of looked at me like, what are you doing here? And I looked at them like, oh, I don't know. Plus, they all went to Greek church and everything. So, they knew how to say Yasu and Kantaten and things like that, which I did. I didn't. So basically, I worked with those girls all through for the next 4 years. We watched them grow up. Some of them babysat for us. One of them even lived with us for a while she was out of money. And I'm still in touch with a couple of them. So it was really fun to do. And then my Greek sort of got to the point where I could at least argue with Bill about things. I could indeed contribute to the reading of the thing. And we just kept at it. It was, we're friends. Our friendship survived the process. Only one or two big arguments.
That's amazing.
It was.
Going through all that.
Right. And it took 10 years. And then we found this guy in England who found out we were doing this. We won a prize for some poems in an English language journal in Greece. And then this publisher found out about us and said, I'm doing these series. So he did it. I mean, this is obscure stuff, and this doesn't have a big audience. But nonetheless, and it's up for another big prize in England now, and if it wins, you know, that'll be fun. That'll be wonderful. So so it's fun to do. So, a very different, a completely different writer than me, a completely different personality than me. You know, I mean, now he'd be probably considered bipolar. Very formal writer, so you know, very different. But the process was great, and you know, I learned Greek, and I went to Greece a couple times, and
that'd definitely be worth it.
Yeah, exactly. It was worth the work. So you know, it's been fun, and you know, we got a pretty book out of it too, and a book I think, you know, the hope that it'll do some good for people who are interested in that and don't have access to the language.
Definitely. So. You've also, along with being a poet and a writer, you've also owned an independent bookstore. What did you like best about that, or least? Or
well, we have to use the right verb. I actually managed an independent bookstore, Shame and Drum Bookshop in Ann Arbor, which still exists. Although you know, it's always touch and go, and you know, if this goes on the web, you know, and it's there 3 years from now, the bookstore may not be. But we keep hoping it will. I moved to Ann Arbor because I was following a woman. I'd been doing a little bit of pickup teaching up at Central Michigan in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. But the woman later married me, which was great, and we're still married.
Okay.
She went down there to get a degree at U of M, and I sort of followed on. And I was at that point, I was sort of sick of, there were lots of reasons, but I thought of sort of sick of being around the fringes of academic life, and I was obviously not going to get the kind of degrees that would move me further in unless I'd done a lot of publishing. So I started working as a bookseller, and I worked for Borders for a long time before they became a chain. And then I wasn't completely comfortable with the movement of the chain, so I went and worked with this, at that time, very small independent bookstore, Shame and Drum, which later expanded and has been a real presence in Ann Arbor for readings and things like that for the last 15 years. That's really the central place for that kind of thing. It kept me really involved with books. And so that passion was always, every day, for 9-10 hours a day, that was the center of my life, getting these books there. I was a pretty good bookseller, and I was good at determining what people really wanted. So, you know, I mean, I was the shopping maven for people all over the state and Northern Ohio, Northern Indiana, who would call up or come up. Most of this was still before there was a lot of web shopping. And they would talk to me and they'd say, you know, I wanted for Aunt Iris. And, oh, well, what does Aunt Iris do? Well, you know, she likes birds. Oh, well, she should read, you know, the new Peter Matheson book or something. So, and I kind of got a reputation for that, and it was kind of fun. I could also do things like I could put poetry in the hands of people who don't usually read poetry. But I didn't try to force my preferences on them. I tried to figure out what they might actually like to read. So I felt as if I did some real work there that was pretty good. It was tiring because it was, you know, it's. I mean, a bookshop like that, you know, you really break your back and hope that things going to break even. When the opportunity came to have me teach more, partly just because I'd made more of a presence of myself as a writer in the world, so that could help justify my lack of any terminal degree. So now we have an MA. So they brought me in to do a little more teaching, and I've kept doing more and more teaching at U of M, and that's been a wonderful job. Of course, it's great to teach those young writers, both undergraduates and graduates at the University of Michigan, is a great privilege. I still get so excited. I, you know, come home and I can't sleep.
Oh, well, that's
so
good.
You know, let me do, which was why I'm tired now. Thursday night,
right.
I had this graduate class in prosody, and I was so worked up. I came home, I couldn't sleep, and I haven't really caught up today either. So.
Well, I can't tell.
Okay, good.
What are your works in progress?
Well, I'm going to read a fair amount about it from that. It's Friday today. On Monday, I sent to Wayne State the revised manuscript of a book I had under contract with them, a new collection of poems. Now, I'm just at the point of finishing that manuscript. I had two contracts I had to fulfill this summer, and I got them both done. The Wayne State one I actually got done on the day it was due. I had another one for an essay that was 3 weeks late, but I did get it done. So right now I'm still in that first blush of having finished a project. It's the bound copy. I'll be reading poems from the bound copy of it tonight, and hopefully they're still going to Wayne State's still going to like it. They gave me a preliminary contract on it a few months ago, but they wanted it to be a bigger book. So that project is just done. It won't be out until the spring of 2009, which the way these University Press things work. It's in a publication series that Wayne State University Press does called Made in Michigan. So I'm very kind of pleased to be in it. Most of my larger books have been published outside New York or the one in England. So it's kind of fun to have this one that's in a series called Made in Michigan. And they've done a really good job with it, so I'm pleased. After that, who knows? I've got a lot of big projects. I got a big project I read here, part of which I read here from 8 years ago, about my family. And I've done more work on that, and I've published a couple of essays from that. And I'd like to do that story. In the 8 years, I've done a lot of research. I have a closet full of research on this stuff now. But, of course, the people that I need to talk to have begun to die. So they've been dying all along, and there are not very many of them left. So, because this is going back into my early, my immigrant ancestors in Western Canada. And so there's that project, which is there. I've got, one of those short novels underway. I've been working with a new small press called Zank Books. It's just a new, and it's in Michigan, believe it or not, and it has money. But it was funded by, had a financial angel who has endowed it to a degree that literary small presses almost never get. So it's going to be around for a while, and it's publishing new fiction. And I'm sort of working as a consultant / reader for that, which is kind of fun. I get paid for it, which is amazing. God bless them all. And so we're publishing some new fiction. The first book of that is going to be out. It's just out in the next couple of weeks and in October of 2007. And then there's another book in February of 2008 by the novelist and short story writer Yannick Murphy. So it's a great project, and it's kind of fun. So that'll be ongoing. That'll take, a fair amount of time. I have, in this new book of poems, I have several longer poems or sequences of poems, and I have the urge to write longer poems. Now, what does that mean? I may not. That may mean every poem I write now is going to be 8 lines long, but it would be nice to be able to write some long poems. So there are lots of things out there. But right now, these two big projects that were over my, when you sign the contract, you got to do them. That sort of was over my head for certainly all the summer and back into the spring, so it was good. The other one of those contracts was for an essay. They asked me to do the entry on Hemingway for the new Harvard Literary History of America. And that's, Harvard University Press gives you a kind, and that, you feel, plus you're a poor farm boy from the prairies, and it was like, ooh, well, Harvard, I got to do that right. It's going to be edited by Grail Marcus and Werner Solers, who are real sort of sexy cultural kinds of critics and sort of out there as public intellectuals in the United States. And I was thinking, I got to write to them. They're going to be much more interested in the image of Hemingway. And I started writing all this. And then somewhere, in early August, I sort of said, hey, wait a minute. I don't know this stuff. I mean, I know Hemingway. I know Hemingway very well. But I don't know all this cultural stuff. And I don't want to pigeonhole them in there anyway. And then I said, well, they asked me to write this. And they knew this. If they wanted a cultural historian or a cultural theorist to write this, there's 1,000 people in 1,000 universities around this country they could have asked who could have done that. But they asked me. So that meant they wanted whatever my take was. So I took my take, and my take on Hemingway, it's not particularly original, although it's not in a majority opinion, but it's that he was completely formed by his childhood summers in northern Michigan, left partly to get away from family troubles, partly to because I think he'd seen the change in the place around outside Petoskey that was caused by people like his own family from Chicago buying up the property. And he left and never came back, but yet that he had that ideal of the woods, of that kind of life, of the native people, and that remained his kind of ideal that he looked for kind of desperately all through his life. And he was back writing about northern Michigan just before he died. One of his great unfinished short stories called The Last Good Country all takes place in northern Michigan again. So that was sort of my point of Hemingway, that he was. And once I realized that, I said, oh, well, I can write this essay. Now, I haven't heard whether they like it or not, so they may reject it entirely. So the only place it'll exist is on this tape.
Well, hopefully they don't, because I know I want to read it.
Good. Well, yeah, hopefully they don't. That's true.
Well, we'll definitely look forward to seeing all your future publications.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Keith, for joining us again here at Michigan State University. For participating in the MSU Libraries Michigan Writer Series. And good luck with your reading tonight.
Thank you. I look forward to it.